Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Millions of New Yorkers could receive checks for $300 to $500 next year. Governor Kathy Hochul announced the idea for inflation refund this week. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell was there and has the details.
Most things cost more money than they did 5 years ago. High inflation rates have made things like gas, groceries, and other household items more expensive. The one piece of good news is that higher prices have brought in more sales tax revenue for New York State, $3 billion to be exact. So at a press conference on Monday, Governor Kathy Hochul said she wants to give that money back.
This is a one-time $3 billion surplus that I believe should be returned to 8.6 million households across New York later this year.
Here's how it would work. Someone making less than $150,000 a year would get a $300 check. A family or household that makes less than $300,000 would get $500 back. Hochul unveiled a few oversized checks on stage to emphasize her proposal.
It's your money, and it should be back in your pockets.
The part of the state hit hardest by inflation is New York City. According to the latest federal data, inflation is at 4% this year in the metro area. That's compared to the national average of 2.6%, which is much closer to what economists want long term. Hochul's proposal comes on the heels of Donald Trump's reelection and a shift towards more kitchen table economic policies. At Monday's press conference in the Bronx, Jennifer Jones Austin applauded the governor's proposal. Jones Austin is the CEO of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies. She said she hears from so many New Yorkers who were on the verge of poverty.
There's one car problem, one layoff, one emergency, one crisis away from being able to get by, let alone get ahead.
Inflation has been easing up from the national high of more than 8% 2 years ago. And according to a survey published Monday by the New York Federal Reserve, people are more optimistic about their finances than they've been since before the pandemic. Still, everyone at Monday's press conference emphasized the need to help New Yorkers now. Grace Bonilla is the president and CEO of United Way of New York City, which operates food pantries around the area.
Last year, 86% increase in visits to pantries was what our system was dealing with. The 500 pantries that we work with knew firsthand what it meant not to have enough food on the table. And we're talking about working New Yorkers.
It's those working New Yorkers that this program is aimed at. But it's unclear what kind of impact a $300 or $500 check could have. A study on the $1,200 stimulus checks paid out during the pandemic found that most people either saved the money or used it to pay down debt. At Monday's event, Governor Hochul said she hoped the money would be enough to encourage working-class New Yorkers to stay in the state.
Our healthcare workers, our bus drivers, our conductors, the laborers, the restaurant hotel workers, the first responders, the teachers, we all depend on them. And I want them to be able to stay here. I don't want people to leave because they can't afford to live in this great state where they started. That would be a travesty.
New York has lost hundreds of thousands of people to out-migration in recent years, a trend many critics blame in part on the high cost of living. The inflation refund proposal needs enough support from New York state lawmakers to make it into next year's budget. Hochul said it's one of the many ideas she plans to introduce during her State of the State address next month. I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
We're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Siena College Research Institute pollster Steve Greenberg to ask him about the governor's favorability numbers in the latest Siena poll and much more.
This is a good news, bad news poll for Governor Hochul. The good news is that for the second consecutive poll, both her favorability rating and her job approval rating are both up a little bit from their all-time lows in September. They came up a few points in October, now up a few points here in December. So where she stands, right now 39% of voters view Kathy Hochul favorably, 49% view her unfavorably. Again, back in September, it was 34-54. So underwater by 20 points, now 39-49, underwater by only 10 points. Job approval rating, even better, getting close to break even. So right now, 46% of voters approve of the job that Hochul is doing as governor, but 49% disapprove. Up from last, from October, when it was 41 approved, 51 disapproved. So a little bit of a bounce back. That's the good news. The bad news is both ratings remain underwater. Her favorability rating has not been positive. We'd have to go back almost a year to the first month of this year in January when she had a 45-42% favorable rating, so on the positive side. But that's the last time. And I think we often talk about a poll as nothing more than a snapshot in time, and that's true. So that's where Hochul stands with voters right now in December 2024. But we can look back over the nearly 3.5 years that Hochul has been governor. And to me, what is amazing is that in a state where 49% of the enrolled voters are Democrats, never once in 3.5 years has Kathy Hochul had a favorability rating that hit 50%. 49 is the highest she has ever gotten on her favorability rating. And after 3.5 years as governor, she's got her work cut out for her because New Yorkers feel like they know her, but they're not happy with the job that she's doing at the moment.
We're speaking with pollster Steve Greenberg of the Siena poll. Now, Steve, I would venture a guess that much like the rest of the politicians in the country, including the still incumbent president Joe Biden, have suffered in the polls largely because of inflation. People's feeling that their pocketbooks and wallets are being hit hard on the essentials like groceries and fuel. Now, a lot of this has come back down to some level, but I can only imagine that has not escaped voters' thinking when it comes to the governor of New York.
Absolutely not. Look, the top issue that voters want the governor, the legislature to address in Albany when they come back to session next month is the cost of living in New York. 43% of New Yorkers say it is the single top issue that they want Albany to address this year. When we ask voters their second choice, if we put them together, so 43% of voters say it's their absolute top choice. 71% of voters, more than two-thirds, not quite three-quarters of voters, say it's one of their top two issues that they want Albany to address. And when we ask voters, over the last year, has the cost of living gotten better, stayed the same, or gotten worse? Only 6% of voters said it's gotten better. Only 17% said it stayed the same. A whopping 76%, three-quarters of New Yorkers, say the cost of living in the state has gotten worse over the last year. So it's the top issue they want voters to, they want Albany to address. It's an issue that they feel has continued to get worse over the last year, and the governor is paying the price for that.
Yeah, and I wonder, you must be itching to find this out. The governor has a new plan that's just come out to give $300 back to New Yorkers as sort of inflation refund because she is recognizing that New Yorkers are upset, just what you said, with the high cost of living. So I wonder what your next poll will find in regard to this idea of giving folks refunds.
Well, we'll certainly, you know, we're going to wait for the governor's state of the state. She's moved the date, so it'll be the second week in January rather than the first week in January. And then in the third week in January, she'll come out with her executive budget proposal. So after the state of the state and the budget come out, we will certainly go in and look at a whole number of different specifics that she's proposing to see if New Yorkers like them or don't like them. Hard to imagine New Yorkers not liking the idea of a tax rebate. You know, up to $300 for an individual who makes, I think, $150,000, and $500 for a family making less than $300,000. It'll be interesting to see how voters feel about that and various other proposals she comes forward with now. As we know, this week she went to a supermarket here in the Albany area and went shopping with a consumer to see about prices of groceries. So it'll be interesting to see how the governor plays this out, what she lays out as her agenda, how successful she is in communicating that to the voters, because, you know, the old cliche, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, it doesn't make a noise. You know, the governor has yet to really connect with the voters of this state. And you know, even when she put congestion pricing on pause back in June and voters supported it, they didn't give her credit. But now that she's putting it back in place for January down in Manhattan, I would imagine, and we will certainly ask early next year to see, do the voters hold her responsible for that increased tax, if you will?
That's Siena pollster Steve Greenberg. You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A nuclear energy resurgence could be coming to New York. As WSKG's Rebecca Rettelmeyer reports, state officials are eyeing nuclear as a way to create power without contributing to climate change.
New York energy officials announced last month that they are gauging interest from companies who want to develop new nuclear power plants in the state. That could be key to helping the state achieve its climate commitments of transitioning away from burning fossil fuels, says Dietmar Dietering, chair of Nuclear New York.
Nuclear has to be part of this, and now the state is getting it.
Generating nuclear power doesn't create any climate warming carbon emissions. Still, many environmentalists have concerns about building more of it. That's because nuclear accidents can be extremely harmful, nuclear waste is dangerous, and nuclear is expensive and it takes a long time to build. One nuclear plant built on Long Island in the 70s cost nearly $6 billion, and it never even opened because of concerns that there would be no safe evacuation route if something went wrong. Raya Salter is a member of New York's Climate Action Council, who opposes nuclear energy development.
We have a long and very troubled experience with nuclear in the past. And when you think about it, going into an increasingly climate unstable and geopolitically unstable world, continuing to build these facilities, I think, continues to pose more threat.
Salter and other environmentalists hope to see the state build more solar and wind power. But those renewables only create power when the weather is right, when the sun shines and the wind blows. That means New Yorkers will still need power from other sources.
That's the big topic right now is how do we fill that gap and how big is that gap?
That's Lindsay Anderson, a professor of biological and environmental engineering at Cornell University. Her research has found that even if the state builds as much wind and solar as it plans to, and has batteries to store some of that energy, it still won't be enough. That's why Anderson believes that looking into expanding nuclear power makes sense.
I don't think we should stop investing in renewables and just go all nuclear, but I think there is definitely a place for it in this conversation.
Four nuclear reactors along Lake Ontario currently provide one-fifth of the state's electricity. In Ithaca, I'm Rebecca Rettelmeyer for the New York Public News Network.
As a way to prevent underage drinking, New York state officials are promoting a mobile ID option for bars, restaurants, and venues. The Legislative Gazette's Alexander Babby reports.
The new app-based form of identification is available after the State Liquor Authority approved guidance allowing the 59,000 institutions under its purview to accept it. State Department of Motor Vehicles Commissioner Mark Schroeder says the app doesn't replace a traditional physical driver's license, but it's meant to make age verification simpler and less invasive when out for a drink, while also safeguarding business owners. He spoke at Common Roots Albany Outpost Monday.
Business owners, you can face stiff penalties for any alcohol sale you may serve to an underage person, so you want to do everything you can to lower your risk. Fake IDs used at bars and concert venues will really be a thing of the past. There's no way to fake a mobile ID.
Schroeder encourages businesses to adopt the ID as an acceptable form of identification. According to the commissioner, more than 160,000 New Yorkers are already using mobile ID, which is available in app stores.
There you go.
Right here?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Lily Fan is chair and commissioner of the State Liquor Authority. She agrees with Schroeder. The digital version is more secure.
A main part of this work is preventing sales to minor. And with mobile ID, our enforcement team, led by Joe Finelli, feels that the technology will make it more difficult for fraud and for kids to pretend to be someone else while they enter facilities.
Common Roots' Rich Wilson says not only is it more secure, it's more private.
The mobile ID platform is seamless, it's quick, and it also protects our guests who might not want to share the full amount of information as shown on their physical ID, because the digital ID allows that to just be a verifiable identification without showing a home address or other sensitive personal information.
Schroeder and DMV Director of Public Information Walt McClure demonstrated how the app works, noting it needs a 6-digit PIN or Face ID to open.
Walt has unlocked his mobile ID. Now he has the option to share his identity with Rich. Walt presses the button, and this generates a QR code. Now, Rich can use that code to verify Walt's identity.
Schroeder says the information is transmitted via Bluetooth, no internet required.
No one at the DMV or the state of New York track where you use your MID. In fact, the technology was designed specifically to give users the privacy. All the app does is authenticate age through DMV's records to tell the bouncer, bartender, or brewer that the person is old enough to be served.
State Restaurant Association President and CEO Melissa Flyshoot says the shift keeps New York current.
This not only protects patrons, but also safeguards the establishments from potential legal issues. Mobile ID is gaining momentum across the globe, and the hospitality industry needs to be ready to accommodate all these guests.
DMV Deputy Director of Investigations Todd Patorti says users' information is safeguarded.
It is encrypted end-to-end, and then when it gets onto the device, it lives only on the holder's device. It is encrypted in the secure element within that device and is only released to a verifier, such as a restaurant or tavern, when it specifically requests certain data from the holder.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Alexander Babby.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, will become Marist University next year. The State Board of Regents approved a motion to grant Marist University status at its meeting this week. College President Kevin Weinman says the new name will not result in any major changes for faculty or students, but he hopes it will help Marist better market itself to prospective students and athletes around the world. Weinman spoke about the move with the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King.
Marist has come a long way in its 95-year history, particularly over the last 20 or 30 years as we've grown from a small school that used to serve largely the Poughkeepsie region, students from the Poughkeepsie region, many commuter students, to now an institution that draws students from around the country and around the world. We looked at ourselves and said, hey, we've got six colleges and Division I athletics, 50 majors at the undergraduate level, 15 graduate degrees, a doctorate program, a branch campus in Florence. If you just looked at Marist from afar, you'd say, hey, that's a university. And so we've sort of become more like a university than a college over a long period of time. But yet we are really proud to hold on to those roots of a small, you know, we say we act big, but think small in terms of small class sizes and interpersonal interaction between students and faculty. And so we want to retain the very best of what it means to be a college, but also signal to the world that we've arrived as a university.
Tell me a little more about, I guess, that signal, because I mean, even regionally, like, you know, Poughkeepsie and the Hudson Valley have a lot of colleges, but not universities.
Yeah, I mean, right now as a college, we worry, you know, there's 4,000 choices students have across the country, right? And some of them who want a university-like experience look at Marist College. We may not get a second look from them, right? Now, by calling ourselves Marist University, they'll say, hey, it's like, you know, let's see what's going on there. Oh, wow, they have all these amazing things that, you know, I thought was only available at a 40,000 person university. And so we do think that this will help us tell our story better. Internationally, the word college means high school or community college. And so trying to appeal to talented international students who would love to come to Marist and we would love to have them here is difficult when we call ourselves a college. So the word university will just signal, again, who we are to a broader audience. And we're very excited to continue to expand our national and international footprint.
Does this name change anything for students or for faculty at Marist?
Yeah, we've been really clear with really everyone, faculty, students, and alumni, who initially might have some hesitancy that the word university might signal things like, hey, are we looking to get a lot bigger? Are we looking to emphasize research over teaching? Are we looking to emphasize graduate programs over undergraduate? The answer is no on all of those things. Then really nothing changes. We produced a strategic vision for the future called Marist 100 about a year ago that takes us to and beyond our centennial celebration in a few years. We are not revisiting that plan. Every word still holds here because we're Marist University tomorrow versus Marist College today does not change our fundamental nature. So we've been able to put a lot of concerned minds at ease that, hey, this is not signaling a drastic new direction. We, of course, always want to be a better Marist, and that's true regardless of what we call ourselves. So we are going to make investments in facilities and individuals and supporting our students and faculty as we go forward. That's all outlined in the strategic vision. But there's nothing about Marist University that suggests that we're a drastically different institution when the name changes.
I guess, how do you view the current landscape for private colleges and universities? You know, it's no secret that here in the state, there have been multiple campuses that have closed in recent years.
Yeah, you're right. And it really started during the pandemic as we saw a lot of folks step away from higher education. And some of them didn't come back even when the pandemic lifted. So yes, you are seeing struggling private colleges have a tough go of it. We're in a very different universe. We've built a very strong institution in every way imaginable. Our goal is to become even stronger and to improve the forms of education in and out of the classroom for our students here. So, you know, we're not doing this because we're worried about our future. We're doing it because we think this is a moment of strength and opportunity for Marist. But it is tough, right? There are many choices out there. Cost is, of course, an issue. We try to make ourselves affordable through targeted financial aid for students with need to the greatest degree possible. But we are mindful that there are headwinds out there, and we need to continue to distinguish ourselves and tell our story better every day so that we can succeed in a challenging landscape.
So in your view, you know, what does it take for a college or a university to thrive and be successful nowadays?
Yeah, it's we occupy a sweet spot, which is our greatest strength, in that students and faculty are attracted here because of the emphasis on teaching and small classes. Our students are taught by faculty, not by graduate students. Right. That's worked really well for us. Yet we've expanded some very exciting programs. We have one of the best fashion programs in the country, both design and merchandising, cybersecurity, computer science, accounting, finance. The whole range of academic offerings is available here. And that's grown gradually over time. And again, one of the reasons why we look at ourselves in the mirror and say, you know, this really looks like a small university to the eye.
Well, we're almost halfway through the academic year here. What else is coming down the pipeline at Marist?
Well, one thing we're very excited about is we just opened the Dyson Center, which is a spectacular new 110,000 square foot building that houses our schools of management and social and behavioral sciences. So a third of Marist students spend most of their time in this state-of-the-art facility that has really elevated learning in those disciplines, but yet the building also functions as a second student center. So we're really focused here on, you know, I call it the 168 hours in a week, right? Students are only in class about 12 to 15 hours a week. Those other 150 hours give us immense opportunity to help them grow and develop in other ways. And thinking about building projects, not as bricks and mortar, not even just as places for learning in a classroom, but for how students can learn by working together in groups and socializing and relaxing between classes, right? It's what students get out of a four-year educational experience that makes it so rich. So we'll continue to do things like that. Our strategic plan calls for investing in the academics as we look to adapt what we teach and how we teach it to meet student demand and societal need and the expertise of our faculty. The student experience, as I mentioned before, mental health, physical health, the holistic ways in which we take care of our students while they're here for 4 years. And then expansive community is our third goal, which is introducing Marist to more audiences from further afield and from different backgrounds that in the past haven't looked as much to come to college at Marist. So that's really our vision for the future.
That's Marist College President Kevin Weinman speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2450. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustino. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.